it's not uncommon to think that when your mom or dad or another family member dies, that the estate is equally divided between your surviving brothers or sisters. But this isn't necessarily the case. As we famously saw after Prince's death, a fight can ensue between siblings or surprise heirs. Prince did not leave any legal documents that determined what would happen with his $250 million estate. Whether you're a multimillionaire, rock star, or just a blue-collar 8-to-5 worker, the battle at the end can get messy. I'm Norma Martinez in for David Martin Davies. Today on The Source, we'll discuss end-of-life planning, the legal aspects, and the kind of care we can hope to receive as we near the end. And in the studio joining us today is KT Whitehead, elder law attorney with the Whitehead Law Firm, Sandra Sanchez Riley, professor in palliative medicine section chief at UT Health San Antonio. And on the line with us is Kelly McLean. She is a comedian and the host of the When You Die podcast. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with you, KT, an elder law attorney. If you can let us know what an elder law attorney is.
Sure. Elder law is a new specialty, and it involves a more holistic approach to legal planning. We try to look at the whole system. It's not just what happens at death. It's that messy period in between a catastrophe, a last illness, or something that's going on in life. So we try to figure out how to approach that holistically and hopefully do some preventative planning, particularly when it comes to incapacity or periods of physical disability.
And Sandra, you're a palliative medicine section chief at UT Health San Antonio. Palliative care is, I'm thinking, a new term we're not hearing very much of. If you can enlighten us as to what a palliative care specialist is.
Absolutely. Palliative care is a medical specialty, sort of like cardiology or oncology, if you will. And it deals with patients who have an incurable disease, patients who have uncontrolled symptoms. We make patients feel better and prepare the patients and family for the end of life, because these illnesses are to be incurable.
And Kelly, you're the host of the When You Die podcast. Can you let us know what that podcast covers? Obviously death, but can you give us a bit more details?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we look into what happens to the body and consciousness and even kind of the spiritual side of it when you die. I've had the pleasure of talking with a lot of the leading voices in the death positive movement, and really in death and dying in general, just to kind of break the taboo. And in a sense, we're seeking to rebrand death, because it is kind of the final frontier of what is taboo in conversation. And as a result, people find themselves at the end of their lives unprepared for the kind of disputes that can happen among family members, as you guys were saying, and, you know, all aspects of it. So we just want to host the conversation and prepare people for what is definitely coming, because death isn't going anywhere. So let's talk about it.
Well, this is a community conversation. We ask you to join in at 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can also email us your comments or questions at thesource@tpr.org. We're also live tweeting right now at TPR Source. So, KT, let's sort of go with the technical aspects of death planning. There are a lot of documents that are involved when planning for death, and I think something like that, just facing the technical aspects, is something that a lot of people might be reluctant to do, as far as finding out what you need to do to draw up a will, power of attorney. Where's the best place people might want to start?
I always suggest you go to an attorney. I think board certified attorneys are often more informed and keep more current than just a traditional family attorney. But a family attorney can certainly give you a start. I encourage people not to go online or download forms. They're often filled out incorrectly, not witnessed properly, and can actually cost the family much, much more in the long run because of the bad form. Texas is a community property state. If they were drafted up north or on the East Coast, they might not accommodate that. Also, we have a very progressive probate system that's independent, and they may not accommodate the independent executor. So if you draft them up formally, you're more likely to avoid those pitfalls that save the family time and money in the long run. I think they're basic documents families need to have. The first is a will. It's important to remember that only takes effect at death. So when mom and dad are living, the will has no effect. The law assumes you can change that will right up to the last moment. You also, I would recommend on the financial side that you consider a power of attorney. This enables someone to step in maybe when you're traveling, when you're out of town, when you may be ill for a period of time, or if you have an incapacity. On the personal side, we always do a medical power of attorney and a directive to physicians. The medical power of attorney is the broad document that covers making general medical decisions for someone who's unable to make them. The directive to physicians is the life or death decision, and you actually decide in Texas's document whether or not you would like life support or you do not want life support. And it's important to remember that these documents only take effect, the medical documents, when you are unable to make decisions. So as long as you're capable, you'll be in charge of making those decisions. The final document that we do is a pre-need declaration of guardianship. And again, we hope you never need this, but if you're incapacitated and you're alive, we don't want your family fighting over who's in charge. So this gives us the ability to say daughter A, son A, or whomever it is, a friend of the family. And this is particularly important in non-traditional families or second marriages or single-sex relationships, because these are the areas where the standard statutory decision-making process, you may fall out of that lineup.
So you were talking about some of these non-traditional unions. Are there places, for example, here in Texas where you draw up a will, you're a same-sex couple, and you share the custody of a child? Are there places where if one of the couple dies, if there's going to be any question as to where or who is going to be taking care of the child? Is it going to be the surviving spouse, or is that person going to be a ward of the state?
I think that gets really complicated, because it's important to figure out, was the child adopted? Was it a child of the union? And was the child, how was it legally handled? Is it a child from a prior relationship in a divorce setting? So it can be very, very complicated, and it is extremely important that people in second marriages and non-traditional families get good, solid advice, both in when they're setting up the relationship legally and when they're planning for death or disability.
Well, it sounds like a pretty complicated issue. We'll try to straighten it all out for you. We'll invite you to join the conversation. Again, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. If you have questions, legal questions, or if you have questions about palliative care, or perhaps you have a comment to share about how you talk with your family about the inevitable. Again, the number is 210-614-8980. You can also tweet us at TPR Source, and you can email us your questions or comments at thesource@tpr.org. We'll be right back.
There are already record numbers of us living with chronic and terminal illness and into ever older age. And we are nowhere near ready or prepared for this silver tsunami. We need an infrastructure dynamic enough to handle these seismic shifts in our population. Now is a time to create something new, something vital. I know we can because we have to. The alternative is just unacceptable.
That's an excerpt by B.J. Miller talking at a TED Talk recently. He's a triple amputee. He suffered a freak electrocution sometime in his college years, and he's now a palliative care specialist at the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. And B.J. Miller is an individual who's also sort of trying to put forth a death-positive attitude when it comes to communicating about death. We invite you to join in the conversation. We're talking about end-of-life care and the end-of-life planning. 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We have KT Whitehead, elder law attorney with the Whitehead Law Firm, joining us. Sandra Sanchez-Riley, a palliative care specialist at UT Health San Antonio. She's a professor and a palliative medicine section chief there. Plus, she's also chief of geriatrics at the South Texas Veterans Healthcare System. And Kelly McLean, the host of When You Die podcast. Kelly, that clip you share on your When You Die website, can you tell us a little bit more about maybe what BJ is trying to communicate?
Yeah, well, I think what he's trying to say is, you know, that we talk about higher powers in different religions, but death is really this one higher power that we're all going to answer to. And he's saying, you know, we may not want to think about it, but we have to think about it. We have to talk about it. And we put a lot of excitement and awareness into the birth of a child, for instance. And death is really just as important, a pivot, you know, turning point on the, in the circle of life as birth. And in some ways, it really can affect our loved ones for the rest of their lives. So we just basically need to stop being shy about it. The term death positive actually comes from the term sex positive. And there was a period where, you know, sexual education was a little repressed and there was some shyness around it. And then it really, in the 90s, people wanted to just come out and talk about it. So I think he is kind of saying, let's talk about death, baby, because we got to figure out how to, you know, end well.
And again, like you say, the first thing we really have to do is to start talking about it. And I think the one thing, once we get past that initial conversation of what do you want to do with mom after she's gone, you talk to your kids, this is what I want to do. Of course, you have to go into the legal category. And Tony right now has a question about the legal impact of remarriages. Tony, can you enlighten us a little more?
The question is, well, I remarried and I have one daughter. And my wife brought up the fact that if something happened to me, my daughter would have access to what was mine. And even though she's an adult and everything, my wife also has four girls as well. I have one daughter and she has four. And I'm wondering, you know, how much of a problem is that going to cause? Because I don't know if they have access to everything that we have or only to what I have. And so, you know, a lot of unanswered questions there.
Well, KT, looks like this is up your alley.
I think the important message is that these are exactly the kind of situations where it's important that you do some planning. In Tony's situation, he has one daughter, his wife has four. Are you planning to plan for all five children? Are you wanting to make your spouse the priority and leave something to your children if there's anything left at their death? How much did you bring into the marriage? How long is the marriage? Did you have a prenuptial? And again, these are hard questions and ones that can't really be answered without knowing a lot more about you and your wife. And it needs to happen on an individual basis. Each family is different and everyone handles this different, but it is extremely important. And it's even more important that people understand this in terms of beneficiary forms, their life insurance, their 401ks, their IRAs. All of these are part of that planning and need to be brought in and talked about so that it's looked at a whole and not as one specific item.
And it looks like, you know, our three guests here, Kelly, Sandra, and KT, it seems like all of you sort of overlap in various ways when it comes to approaching death. Kelly is trying to sort of reinforce the fact that it's okay to talk about dying and there really shouldn't be a taboo about it. And then KT is sort of stepping in to say, this is once you're comfortable talking about it, let's go ahead and do something about it. And Sandra, you sort of step in and say, well, once we're dying, we're in the state where we're in a condition where we're hospitalized, what can be done? And so what's an example, Sandra, of some of the care that you give to some of the people that you find there at UT Health San Antonio? What's different about palliative care versus, say, hospice?
Of course. Actually, hospice is a small part of palliative care. When the patients receive the hospice benefit, they already know that they have a very limited prognosis, meaning they're going to die within months. And at that point, families are already focusing on having the patient or their loved one being comfortable, hopefully at home or in a facility, receiving symptom management, making sure that their last days are comfortable and they're well cared for. Palliative care is a bigger dimension, meaning that when the patient gets diagnosed with a disease that is not going to be curable, then they start planning for the future, making arrangements about what kind of decisions they are going to be doing, how do they want to pursue their medical care, how do they want to take care of all their affairs. And as the time goes by and their illness become worse and worse, if you would, then the patients are placed eventually on hospice. So palliative care should start much earlier and is a medical part of the planning process. Just as we were talking about the legal part, there is also a medical part. So the whole planning process should start way earlier.
Our number again for you to join into the conversation is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And we have Kim on the line. Kim, you lost your sister a year ago, and you have a comment about the hospice care she received?
Sure. It was actually my father. I apologize. I've lost my voice a little. Okay. It was actually my father after a very long battle with cancer, and he did go into hospice. He actually lasted about 6 months after he was determined to be a hospice patient, and he was in hospice at home. And the situation that we ran into, which I think is probably common and not talked about, is the amount of help that we were provided by, that was covered under insurance. They threw a lot of equipment at us, and that wasn't a problem. He was bedridden. We had a very nice hospital bed, oxygen machines, pretty much whatever we needed equipment-wise. But in terms of actual people there to help, we were able to get an aide once a day to bathe him, you know, change his clothes, whatnot, and a nurse once a week to check in, check on his medication. But otherwise, it was my mom and I 24/7. Taking care of a bedridden patient. And I wonder what we could have done or what someone could do to be more prepared financially for that burden.
Sandra or Katie, you have a response?
I'll comment on on the medical aspect. So, Kim, I'm sorry for your loss, and it sounds like the experience had mixed feelings. When a person is enrolled in the hospice benefit, indeed they provide medical equipment and they provide nursing visits and home health visits to provide personal care. But in the hospice benefit, and this is regulated by the government, the routine care is expected to be delivered the majority of the time by the family. The hospice gets reimbursed for a daily rate, and that's what covers. It covers the medicine, it covers the equipment, it covers the medical care that it receives. It is expected that the family will deliver a great amount of care, unless there is privately paid, in which, yes, that requires lots of financial planning to cover for that.
I agree, and I think you asked a really valid question. How do you prepare financially? None of us know how long that period's going to last or how short it's going to be. I think it's important to remember, first of all, to use the finances to take care of the caregiver, because what we don't want are you and your mother getting sick, because then we've lost the game entirely. And so make sure that there's adequate respite care and that the finances are used for that. There's very little or no public assistance for in-home care, and it's oftentimes very difficult to acquire and even to apply for. I tried to assist a client last week and couldn't find the actual application for the program that was defined on the state's website. I asked another assistant in my office to look who was more adept at this, and neither of us could. So I think it's those resources are very, very scarce, and hospice does rely on the family. There is inpatient hospice care, but that's only at the very, very end, or if you're already in a nursing home or other facility, you may be able to have support and services, but those are part of the planning process, and it's a hard process. It's not easy, and I think the decisions that get made about care start really early, like Dr. Sanchez was saying, and it begins with simple decisions following up a medical procedure when someone is older or when you have an unexpected crisis, and it's recognizing that talking with the doctors and the care staff and really educating yourselves so that you're understanding the subtext of what the doctors are saying, because I think a lot of times patients aren't able to hear because we all want to be hopeful and positive, but sometimes what the doctors and the care staff are saying are just in case, what do we do? And it's important to ask the doctor about the changes in care that will happen if you do a certain procedure or you do a certain test. It came up last week when I was making decisions about someone who is on hospice, and one of the staff wanted to draw blood. And I asked the question, how is that going to change the treatment you're giving him? And the answer was, it won't. It'll just give me the answer. And so I said, well, why don't we just give him the care anyway, which was adding some protein to the diet. But those are the kinds of questions that families need to be able to ask and feel empowered to ask early on to the doctor so that the doctor can give you good information, or the support staff at the hospital, the nurses, the aides, the people who are caring, and the social workers.
Kelly, really quickly, we're going to be coming up on a break here very shortly, but do you have any advice for somebody who might be in Kim's situation? Kelly?
I'm right here. I can't imagine being in Kim's situation, but I think reaching out to a community of people that is very strongly there, particularly online, who have been through what Kim has been through, is probably a good starting point.
All right. Well, we are going to take a break here in a couple of minutes, but we're going to explore when we come back what's literally going to be happening to us when we're dead. There's a lot of options for us, not just burial necessarily, not necessarily cremation. But let's explore, before we get to that topic, again, we're going to dedicate that a little bit later, but let's explore a few more, just very briefly. We're going to explore this question with a caller, but there sometimes is a difference of opinion on what's going to happen to the members of the family after they're dead. And does there necessarily have to be an agreement between the two? One wants to be buried, one wants to be cremated. We'll be exploring that. So we want you to join into the conversation. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. We're live tweeting as well at TPR Source. Email us your questions or comments at thesource@tpr.org. Do you have a story to share? Do you know what is going to happen with you after you died? And what led you to make that decision? Again, share with us your story at 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You're listening to The Source. I'm Norma Martinez in for David Martin Davies, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source. I'm Norma Martinez. Joining us in the studio are K.T. Whitehead, elder law attorney with the Whitehead Law Firm, Sandra Sanchez Riley, professor in palliative medicine, section chief at UT Health San Antonio, and Kelly McLean, the host of the When You Die podcast. We're talking about end-of-life issues. And the number to call in is 210-614-8980. Again, that's 210-614-8980. And we have a couple of calls talking about what's going to happen to their bodies after they are dead. And first, we're going to go to Jose. Jose, apparently there's a difference of opinion between you and your spouse.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, let us know.
Well, we've been discussing this for a while, and because we're here, and tomorrow we don't know where we're going to be. But we've been together for over 24 years, been married for a little bit over 3 years, and we don't agree sometimes what's going to be the very part. I will do whatever he asks me to do, but I just find that out that he will not cremate me.
KT.
So what can I do to make sure I will get cremated?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is to make sure you do good pre-planning for any post-death arrangements. That can be anything from a prepaid funeral to joining things like the nonprofit San Antonio Funeral Alliance or the Neptune Society, or going to a traditional funeral home. You can set up what you want to have happen to your body after your death with these organizations or a funeral home in advance. It is very important, if you want to be cremated, that you make sure that you sign the paperwork while you're alive. This means that your wishes are carried out and not your spouse's. And so it's very important that you get that done, Jose. And I would encourage you to contact first the nonprofits and talk with them about the services. Generally, it's setting an intent. You don't actually prepay for the services with the nonprofits. If you want to actually prepay, you go to the funeral homes and make those arrangements. But it is important that you get all of that paperwork signed. You can also create a legal document that designates someone to take control of your body at death so that your wishes are followed.
And Sandra, is this something you encounter quite a bit when you're caring for patients?
Many times. People don't think about these details until the very end. And I have had non-traditional families or traditional families kind of been disagreeing, especially at the very end, for where they're going to go. As we approach in the end, and our families are starting to talk about it, then we realize, well, we want a burial versus we want a cremation, or we wanted a non-traditional way to go, or donating the body, and religion beliefs come into place many times as well. It is something that 100% of us will deal with. Preparing for it is the best way to go.
And Charlotte, I see, also has a question about a burial alternative. Charlotte?
Yes. I'm 70 years old, and I guess my family, and I'm talking about my parents who are deceased, were, I guess, ahead of the time or whatever. I mean, we talked about death. It wasn't a big deal. You know, it just was another stage, I guess, or we didn't know. But it was good in the sense that I heard one of your speakers talk about cost and so on. And I have said to my children over and over, please do not spend any money on me to keep me alive. I'd rather you have the money than the doctor have the money. And I say that over and over, and I think they do have it. But anyway, I was looking for alternatives to burial. And I had gotten a book when I retired called 365 Ways to Change the World. One of them, you each day you read one. So one of them, I don't remember which day it was, but say March or 10th or whatever, someday, it was saying that you, to help the environment, because there are different topics of things you can do, and one of them is the environment. And there's a lot of topics on the environment, but one of them was being buried and what the laws are about being buried, that you don't have to be buried in a coffin and formaldehyde and all these things that are very bad for the environment. You could be buried in a forest. Now, this book was written in Britain, you know, so I haven't been able to locate any place around in Texas that you could do that. You know, that was one option. I did check with UT Medical Center here in San Antonio about they take your body after, and they have you know, they gave me all the options that you could have. They use it, I think, with their medical students. But my understanding was your body had to be perfect.
Well, we'll talk about that here in just a little bit. So thank you so much for sharing that, Charlotte. A lot of options are available for us. And actually, Kelly, we want to bring you into this conversation because we had Charlotte bring up a really interesting point where you can just bury a body in a forest. You actually have discussed on one of your past podcasts a green burial. Can you please sort of let us know what this green burial is all about?
Absolutely. So this is really kind of on the rise right now. And a lot of people do not want their final act to be harmful. They don't want it to be a middle finger to the environment, so to speak, which, you know, cremation, which is over 50% of people at this point are cremated. And I always thought I would want to be cremated, but learning about the greenhouse gases and the effect on the environment, I've rethought that. So there are some really exciting alternative options right now. One of them is aquamation, which was just legalized in California last week, actually, which is a water process that breaks down the body, and then you're left with kind of a metallic white powder rather than ashes to scatter for the loved ones.
How would you scatter sort of a powder?
It literally is the same as ashes, but kind of prettier. It's kind of like pearly and lovely. But it's the same process. You know, it's the same kind of scattering thing. And in terms of green burial, a lot of people, there are now green burial sites cropping up all around. There's definitely Brian Flowers runs a really great one in Washington. So sometimes we joke that you might have to do a weekend at Bernie's and, like, you know, smuggle the body into another state because it depends where the resources are really at. And I can't speak to Texas particularly, but I know in Washington and in California and many states, we have green burial sites where the body is generally shrouded in a biodegradable shroud. And it's actually very beautiful the way that the body is lowered into a plot, just as it would if it was in a coffin. But it essentially recomposts and becomes part of the earth. And so instead of taking from the earth, it ends up kind of offering the nutrients to the earth in the end, which appeals to a lot of people. Also, green burial sites are usually, the people that run them are usually, it's not all about money. They kind of want to create a ceremony and a situation for the family. So sometimes people dig their own, their family's own burial plot, you know, for a loved one.
Well, a lot of people bury their dogs in the backyard, right? So,
yeah, absolutely.
Well, Sandra, you have something you wanted to add to the conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, just to our Texas listeners, right here in San Antonio, in La Vernia, actually, we do have a green burial cemetery at Countryside Memorial Park. So there is an option locally if people are interested. But I also wanted to bring the concept of organ donation as well as body donation. Our UT Health Science Center, our medical school, can definitely use the bodies to learn about the body and to conduct research. And so that's a very wonderful way of contributing to science if people were interested. And there are many other organizations that can take organs and body for the good of humanity in the future to pass that on.
Now, Charlotte, when she called, she said that the folks that she had spoken with, that they told her that the body has to be perfect. Our bodies are not perfect.
No.
So what would the requirements be? Maybe somebody wants to be an organ donor, but they also want to donate their body to science. Could they do both?
Organ donors have some limitation depending on the organ. But organs like, for example, the cornea, they don't require a lot of a perfect body, although none of us, as you said, have a perfect body. Organ donation is a little bit more restricted, but definitely you can still donate some of the organs. In terms of body donation to advance science to a medical school, for example, there is the Center for Emergency Services in Boulevardi also that will receive bodies for children to learn about anatomy, for example. And those bodies are far from perfect. We actually want imperfect bodies so we can learn about, you know, bad kidneys and what was the reason. And at the Health Science Center, we want to learn about, okay, if you have cirrhosis, do you have a bad liver? I can see it. And then the students will never forget it. So imperfect bodies are always welcome.
Our number again is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We only have about a minute, KT, but, you know, we know that funeral planning is expensive, whether or not you're going for cremation, the full-fledged burial. But what kind of funeral scams, if you could just tell us quickly, that people might want to be looking out for? Because I'm assuming there are probably some folks out there who are willing to take advantage, because when a person dies, all of a sudden your phone just starts ringing off the hook.
I think the funeral scam is actually part of, it's not necessarily a scam, but overselling at the time of death by the funeral homes. Remembering that you don't have to have embalming, you don't have to have a lot of the technical things that they may be a cemetery requirement, but not necessarily a legal requirement. So I think raising the issue about what services really are necessary and remembering you're not acting out of grief, and that's why planning is so important.
Again, you can join in the conversation at 210-614-8980. When we come back, we'll be talking about what's the best way to approach your loved ones about what's going to happen to you after you die. We're going to come right back. You're listening to The Source. You're listening to The Source. I'm Norma Martinez in for David Martin Davies. Today we're talking about end-of-life planning. We invite you to join in the conversation at 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can tweet us at TPRSource or email us your comment or question at thesource@tpr.org. You know, sometimes it's just very uncomfortable to talk about death. Sometimes the conversation will lead the other person at the other end of the line to say, I don't want to talk about it, because if I talk about it, it's going to happen. Well, it's going to happen whether or not we talk about it. There are individuals, though, who know from the very beginning that their lifespan is going to be shortened. For example, cystic fibrosis. And right now we're going to hear from a young lady who has her own YouTube channel. Her name is Claire Wineland. She's an Austin native, and she has terminal cystic fibrosis. Let's hear from her right now.
On my YouTube channel, I've covered stuff like what it's like to actually be in a coma, how to talk to people who are sick, what not to say to people who are sick, stuff like that. Sorry, this was so depressing. Here's a little joke to make it better. What is the biggest downside of sudden unexpected death? Being unable to delete your search history. And it's interesting looking at, you know, the way that other people live their lives, which is, you know, they've never really had to think about death. That's never been a constant in their life. So I think fundamentally at the end of the day, it doesn't matter really whether you're scared of death or whether you're scared of paying your bills. We all have things in our life that are just completely foreign. That's the reason that death is so scary, is because it's so foreign.
And again, I don't know if too many people have come back from the dead to really tell you what it's all about. Some people have had those near-death experiences, but that's another show. But I think Claire brings up a really good point. It's an unknown that we eventually have to embrace and accept. And so, Kelly, we're going to go to you. What do you think is the first step we need to take in opening up that conversation? By the way, Kelly is the host of the When You Die podcast, in case you just tuned in. Kelly, what do we need to do to start that conversation? Do we need to gather the family around, sit them on the couch, or do we just bring it up in casual conversation?
Well, it's pretty simple. I think, you know, the just do it approach is the way to go. The first step, maybe whiskey, Norma. I don't know. whatever you need to get yourself in a space where you can have this conversation. But as with any awkward conversation, you know, it's never going to feel like the right time and the right circumstance. You just kind of have to fearlessly jump in and do it. Sometimes people feel as though death is contagious. Death is not contagious. Even talking about it is not going to make it happen. So you just kind of have to cast the superstitions away and jump right in, knowing that, you know, it's really for the benefit of your loved ones, even as awkward as they may feel. It's really for their benefit. So you just got to jump in.
And Kate, yeah, go ahead, Katie.
Oh, I was just saying, I always tell people this is like an insurance policy. If you buy it, you're never going to use it, or it's going to be a long time. So if you plan it, it doesn't mean it's going to happen. It just means it's not going to happen in an emergency. And it's always better to not have a crisis.
And Sandra, what do you think you should add? Because I'm assuming you come across a lot of cultural obstacles when it comes to people talking about death. Do you ever find that, you know, you have somebody there under your care, but perhaps the family still is not willing to accept the fact that their loved one's going to die?
Absolutely. When we are in the hospital and a patient brings their family and a patient is dying or a patient is having a very bad prognosis, if you will, they're worsening, it's time to talk about it. But I try to normalize this situation. I always tell them, okay, I speak about this with all my patients, either in the office, in the hospital, or when they're really, truly dying. And at that point, we need to talk about this. Okay, please tell me, you know, what are your values? What do you want? What are your wishes? Let the patient be the boss, because he or she is the one who are going to make the decisions. And it's the family role to respect it. And at that point, usually when a physician brings this up, it's easier for the families to talk about it. Initiating the conversation by yourself is really hard. So, but actually bringing your own doctor and say, okay, we're here to talk about planning, they'll go along with it. And actually, the doctor will be a good source, kind of a good neutral person to start the conversation.
Well, I'm assuming here in San Antonio and all along the other border states with a heavily Hispanic population, we celebrate the dead when it comes to the Day of the Dead. But there are many people, many Latinos, who are very reluctant to discuss the fact that they're going to die. And I think all of us have seen families that are essentially torn apart because that conversation was never had. Is there maybe a secret you might want to share with us on how to you know, break past those cultural taboos to finally have individuals accept the fact that we need to talk about it, we need to plan for it? Maybe it's a financial obstacle. Maybe people aren't certain how much money it might cost to draw up all these documents. Because at the beginning of the show, Katie, you had a whole long list of obstacles that I think a lot of people were kind of overwhelmed with when it comes to all the documents. And so I'm thinking that perhaps that might be an obstacle when they realize, oh my gosh, all these papers, can't you just copy and paste on every one? Or what's the financial implications of me getting into this? Isn't there a cheaper alternative, a way that fits better into my economy, to my budget?
I think one of the things to remember is there are legal services out there that can help people who don't have a lot of funds. St. Mary's has a wills clinic that they do. Texas Legal Aid, I believe, does wills for people. So there are a lot of options out there to help people who don't have huge resources. But the other is just like paying any other bill. There's a time when you've got to face it and do it. And so plan for it. Make the commitment. Don't put it off because you don't know the answer or you don't know what you want. Open the dialogue. And I think that happens with an attorney who can be your tour guide. That happens with the family when you open the dialogue. And I think there's several, you know, we're talking both pre-death and post-death planning. And I think it's important to recognize that you may want to talk about end-of-life care sooner than you will about actual death planning. I know for years I've known what my mother wanted. She was a hospice nurse and she was really clear. But it's just been in this last week that my parents said, here's what we want after death, up to a point. Now tell us what you want to do as kids. And the discussion went on for a good week of everyone responding. And then my mother saying, well, we'll let you decide when it happens. So I think, you know, that's still an undecisive point. And I don't think we'll talk about it at the Thanksgiving dinner table, but I do think we'll talk about it when we're together as a family.
Precisely. I think starting the conversation from the healthcare point of view helps opening this to people start then talking about kind of what they want. I was also going to say that when you talk about healthcare planning, at a doctor's office, the forms are free and they're available online. And they can be easily filled out. They need a witness and a doctor to sign certain documents. There's not a science to it, particularly for the healthcare aspect of things. So they can start there and then they can move forward to other decisions related to financial.
I think Dr. Sanchez is talking about the do not resuscitate form, and that is actually a doctor's order. It isn't a form that we would traditionally fill out as part of estate planning. And there's out-of-hospital do not resuscitates and in-hospital do not resuscitates.
Absolutely, and the medical power of attorney as well.
Yes, and I believe those are available through the Texas Medical Association online.
Right, as well as yes, absolutely.
So let's go really quickly to Bonnie. She has a question about, say you have an issue, you're in the emergency room. How do responders know what it is that want to happen to your body? Bonnie, can you elaborate, please?
Well, yes, I've filled out the forms to have my body donated to science and to use my organs, whatever's left, it's good. But should I perhaps be in an accident in the highway patrol or whatever and there's no living relatives around? There are certain things I'm understanding that you have to do if you're donating your body that you wouldn't do or that the officials wouldn't do to your body.
Well, that's a good question. Thank you, Bonnie, for that comment. If you are maybe out of the city and you die and your body ends up in a morgue, how are they going to know what is going to happen to your body? You're not necessarily wearing a bracelet that says, I want to be cremated.
It's a tricky one. It depends on where you are and what condition is your body in at that point. The majority of the organizations will take their time to find out if you had any plans. And you also may want to communicate with your family or your loved ones, what is it that you have planned for after you die? That way they can say, okay, she wanted to donate the body to this particular institution or organization. So I will say that within the stay limits, that is still feasible. If the body is in a fairly good condition, I'm not sure about beyond that.
All right, well, really quickly, in about a minute, I sort of want to go around the table here. Kelly, what do you want done with you when you die?
You know, there's a new process called recomposting, which basically consists of surrounding the body with wood chips, and it becomes soil. And so this is what most appeals to me now. It's not yet legal, but they're doing a lot of work to make it legal in Washington, and I have a feeling that that's going to be a trend. And it appeals to me to go back to the earth quite literally.
Sandra, what about you?
I'm a scientist and I'm a teacher.
So donation?
Definitely body donation. I want science to be advanced and I want people to learn more so we can help others.
And KT?
I just want to remind people, too, that if you do donate your body, there's a period where they're done. And so you still have to make plans. And I agree. I would like to have my body donated and anything that's usable, used. But I would like, ultimately, I like the aquamation. I hadn't heard about that. I like that idea or something that's low impact but going to be done.
Well, we want to thank our guests today, Kelly McLean, host of the When You Die podcast, Sandra Sanchez-Riley, professor in palliative medicine, section chief at UT Health San Antonio, and KT Whitehead, elder law attorney with the Whitehead Law Firm. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And we'll be back tomorrow with The Source. I'm Norma Martinez in for David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.